Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, interest rates. This is a topic that, get good notes on it. It's not particularly difficult, but you do have to remember terminology and all of that. There's not a whole lot of math involved. There is some, but it's kind of in the background of this subject. Now, the week will end with a quiz and some last minutes about interest rates and then a quiz. And again, these are preparing you, each one of these. This is one of the difficult ones that gets you prepared for the midterm exam and all that good stuff. So prepare early and often. Before we go to the subject matter, just a quick look around at the news, see if there's anything interesting going on as far as stock prices go. What would you say, madam? Is this a good day or a bad day? What kind of a day is this?
Good day.
Good day? You know, it is kind of, if you're a small stock fan, NASDAQ, but the rest of us almost, it's very quiet. It's a wait and see kind of day. Just see how it just, you got the S&P up a tiny bit, the Dow is down a little bit, and then the NASDAQ is showing some strength today. Well, that's good news, but other than that, it's more of a quiet day. We had couple of these supposed gurus got their information out to people like me who don't care what they have to say, telling us that this is the end. It's coming right now. The whole world is going to crash in a financial apocalypse. And I don't see it there. It may be happening. I'll check outside to see if the sky is falling, but I don't think it is. So you always have to take those kinds of warnings with a very big grain of salt. No, this isn't the end, and it's a day when the market is quiet. One thing let me show you here real quick is if I look at the S&P 500, you see that the volume, we're a little more than halfway through the day. Do you see how the volume is very light? At this point, it should be about half of the average volume or a little more, and I don't see that. It's less than a third. This is a quiet day. One of those where the big players are sitting on the sidelines just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen next. If I look back over here, you're not seeing a whole lot of movement because there isn't a whole lot of capital or money being pushed into the market right now. And what is there is probably going for the small cap stocks, which may have a little life. Crude, look at that. It actually crossed, got close to 95 a barrel early this morning, and it dropped, and now it's coming back up. It wants that 100, as I've told you. It's trying to find it, and I'm thinking probably it'll find it before your spring break, so you'll be driving on expensive gas and all that kind of stuff. Jet fuel prices will go up, too. Of course, that'll make the price of airline tickets go up, although there's a lot of competition. We're definitely heading for 100, and then from there it just gets to be real scary. Once the market has 100 in the rearview mirror, I mean, the dreams are talking about 125 to 150 by summer, and that's really when it gets expensive to drive a car. So you might want to start looking at one of those electrics or hybrids by then. I mean, the days of the cheapo oil are just gone forever. We're never going to see those again. But now, going over here, gold and silver are showing some muscle today, and that's money is going into the metals right now. If you were to look at some of the other metals, they show gold and silver, but by no means are these the only metals that are traded heavy. I mean, platinum, of course, but heavy money goes into copper and other kinds of nickel and some that you probably wouldn't even recognize their names. Now, here's an interesting thing. 10-year bond yields are up, which means the prices are down. So there is a sell-off. That means that if the prices are down, then investors are pulling out of bonds. And why they're doing that? Apparently, they don't see them as a good idea right now. Now, it's interesting because what you're seeing here, see that? What is that? That's 6 basis points up on the yield. I heard, and I didn't get this news directly, but I heard that the Fed held an emergency meeting today, this morning, which means that they may be ready to push interest rates up right now instead of waiting a little while. And that might be why you're seeing these bond yields going up as the interest rate, and which would mean that interest rates are going to go up. And we'll talk about that. That's the sort of the subject of the lecture today. Now, coming over here, as you can see, both London and Tokyo had a nasty day. But interestingly, the nasty part started, and then it just kind of, there was a bull run there for a while, and then the bears took back over, and the Nikkei was just down. So, in other words, something spooked those markets early on, and they never got their feet back under them from that. That was the only news today, was some bad news on both sides of our world. And we're not in that kind of shape yet, though. But that's not a, I mean, there's nothing really spectacular, although the NASDAQ does seem to have be flexing its muscles some. Hard to call right now. But, I mean, even if I were really good at this, I wouldn't want to try to call this market right now. When you have these gurus all saying it's about to end, sometimes that can spook the market for a while if enough of them say that. So, I don't know, maybe that's what's going on today, as everyone's waiting to see if they actually know what they're talking about. I doubt it, though. Anyway, let me... start out with the basics. Interest rates are the rental rate of money. Interest rates are the rental rates of money. That's what they are, rental rate, or a price, if you will. And it is actually a rental rate. Because, well, as a matter of fact, that's the same thing with a wage. A wage is a rental rate. It's not a price of your labor. I'm not buying you. Lord knows you'd be too expensive, and I just can't keep you anywhere. So I'll rent you for something or other. Then that's a wage rate, an interest rate, and a lot of those kinds of rates in finance. They are just rental rates. Now, something, let me... The factors that drive interest rates, and I'm a little bit different from the book in this, but it's basically about the same thing, is factors affecting interest rates. I'm trying to write bigger. The TA and several others said that they can't read it in the back, so if I get small, I'll try to remember resize it again. Factors affecting interest rates. One of those is opportunities. And the book says production opportunities, but it really goes beyond that. The opportunity cost of foregone consumption. For example, sir, do you like steaks? Yes. I do too. So, I mean, if I put my money in the bank, I am giving up the opportunity of having a delicious ribeye. Have you seen those tomahawk steaks, the one with the bone? Yeah, that's the one. Just hold it there. You cook it long enough, eat a piece, and then cook it some more. It's wonderful. But if I put the money in the bank, I don't get that. So it's a matter of the opportunity cost. And then there are other factors that affect interest rates as well. Among them are federal policy. Now, this is more of a short term. There's an old idea that the government, the Federal Reserve, can affect interest rates in the short run, but not in the long run, at least intentionally. In the long run, they have an effect on interest rates, and it could be a very bad effect. But intentionally, their efforts to change interest rates are short run. In other words, if you have a one-year treasury bill, they can move that interest rate all over the place. But a longer interest rate, no. Let's try this, three. Risk is a driving force, and we talk a lot about that in the second half of the course, is that if you have a super safe investment, madam, you would not need as much of a reward for the investment as you would if it were a risky enterprise. If you're going to throw your money into something risky, you darn well better have a good rate of return on it in order to do that. That is a driving principle of finance. It just makes everything in our world happen, is the risk-return relationship. So with greater risk, you expect a greater return. No one is stupid enough to throw risk money at a high-risk project unless there's some good reason to do it. That's just life. That's one of our most fundamental principles in finance, is that risk-return relationship. And in fact, later in the course, I'm going to show you, historically, if you were to look at your return to the Dow Jones Industrial 30 versus your return to the S&P 500 versus your return to the NASDAQ, if you put money into $1,000 into each of these in 1975, you would see the staggering difference between the return that you got to the Dow and the return that you got to the NASDAQ. You're going to get a high, much higher return because you took much greater risk with the NASDAQ. You put your money into the Dow, you're pretty sure you're going to make something off it, but it's not going to be much. And then finally, a major factor is inflation. But I'm going to qualify something that the book doesn't clarify enough. There's a difference between inflation and expected inflation. Inflation is a pain in the butt, and we're all seeing that right now. What is really a disaster is expected inflation. Because once expectations of inflation embed in an economy, you have a hard time. The government has a hard time shaking that out. Because once unions, once companies start to expect inflation to happen, then they get in front of it and they start raising their prices and their wages before the inflation even hits. So even if we stop inflation dead in its tracks, do the things that we can do to make that happen, the markets will tend to hold off believing it for a long time. So once an inflation premium sneaks into interest rates, it just sits there long after it needs to go, it doesn't need to be there anymore. And I'll talk about that in a little while. So I'm going to write here expected inflation. Because this is the one that matters the most. And it's the one that can really hurt an economy. Because the government can print money, and that causes inflation. And it can do that for years and years, and the inflation builds and builds. And then the markets start to believe that it's always going to be there. And they start putting it in, even before it happens. And then the government finds religion and it clamps down the money supply. Supply of money goes down, the price of money, interest rates goes up. But then that inflation premium doesn't go away, so interest rates go up even worse when we finally clamp down. That's what's happening right now, is that the government is in this position where we are beginning to expect the inflation. And once we expect it, the Fed will clamp down on the money supply, but interest rates will still keep going up because the banks, workers, companies will keep pushing inflation into their prices because they don't think the Fed is really serious. I'll talk about that in a little while here. But let me get down to something here. I'm having a hard time because I teach a version of this course for MBA students who've hardly ever had any finance. And I gave them the example of the Treasury auction. Have I told you the Treasury auction yet? Okay, I just want to make sure. I mean, I'm getting a little blurred here on these two. But I'm going to start with an important relationship. Now, when the government borrows money, it does it by selling Treasury debt. If the government wants to borrow $1 billion, it sells $1 billion worth of Treasury bonds or bills or notes. That's how it does it. And that means it is borrowing that. The buyers of those bills are actually lenders. So when the government goes to borrow money, it can borrow it very short term, intermediate term, or long term. And we'll talk more about that next week. But you have to appreciate that when interest rates go up, yields go down, and vice versa. They are inversely related, and it's mathematical. It's not a theory. It's just the math of it. You'll see the math. That's how it works. So do understand that when interest rates go up, the price of debt goes down. That's why I keep saying, well, yields went up today, so that means that interest rates went down today. That's what that means. So keep that in mind as we're going along here. Now, start with this. The real rate of return, the real rate, and I'll designate that R sub real, this is a hidden rate. It's the core underlying rate. It is driven by the supply of and demand for money. It is underneath, and we can't actually see it directly. It's interesting that in nature, there are things we know are there, but we cannot see them. We have to infer. Sometimes we can do some very powerful statistical analysis, probability theory, and all that, and we can tease them out, but we can't see them directly. For example, in physics, if any of you have ever encountered quantum mechanics, we know that there are these little tiny things called quarks, and they are the building blocks of every subatomic particle. But we cannot see a quark. But we know they are there. We know how they work. We know how their effects are. This is the same thing with this real interest rate. We cannot see it because it's always hidden in this mass, larger mass. But anyway, here's the demand for money. Now, if you remember from your macroeconomics, whoever taught it, that at any given time, the supply of money is a fixed amount, supply of money. And the supply and demand intersect at the real rate. Now, why can't we see this? Well, for one thing, the supply of money, we can pretty much tell what that is at any given time. But the demand for money is just a demand curve. It's more of a theoretical thing. Actually, calculating demand curves, even in microeconomics, is a pain in the butt. At the macro level, figuring out the nation's demand for money, never could do it. But we do know that it creates this real interest rate. So when the Federal Reserve increases the supply of money, that brings the real rate down from R1 real to R2 real. This has been our policy. Whenever there is hints of a recession or something like that, the Fed starts printing money, supply of money goes out, so the price of money, the real interest rate, goes down. And that's the Fed monetizing, as we say, adding liquidity. sending money out into the economy. They do it in a weird way. It's called an open market operation. I'll talk about those later. But that's what we've been doing. We were teetering on the brink of too much growth in about 2016, 2017. And it would have done the Fed good to have slowed down the economy by decreasing the money supply, raising real interest rates, and cooling off the economy for a while, snuffing out inflation, snuffing out hypergrowth when it was early on. And the Fed probably was planning to do that. But the president at the time threatened to fire the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. Whether he could have or not is highly doubtful. But he spooked the Fed, and the Fed abandoned any plan whatsoever to decrease the money supply. So that was done. And the Fed instead just kept juicing the money supply, increasing it more and more and dropping interest rates more and more, stimulating the economy, growing it faster and faster, because this is what the president wanted. Obviously, any president wants a good, juiced economy because it makes him more popular. And that's what happened. And he's not the first president who has done that. He's the first one who directly threatened the Fed. No one had ever done that before. But one way or the other, the economy just kept juicing more and more, lowering interest rates more and more, which stimulates economic growth, more borrowing, more spending, all of that good stuff. Wonderful. But anyway, that's the real interest rate. It is driven purely by the supply of and demand for money. We don't see that interest rate, though, because that one is always attached to that expected inflation premium. That's always there. You cannot see an interest rate that doesn't have an expectation of inflation embedded in it. It could be a tiny expectation. It could be an insanely large expectation, but it's always there. We never see a rate that is not these two paired together. That's why I said the real interest rate, it's kind of like almost like a theoretical thing. We can't see it. We know it's there. We know it's driving things, but it's always going to be attached to this. Let me try this. Sir, have you ever left your apartment and forgotten to put on your meat suit? Just your skeleton and some organs walking around?
I always do too.
Never forget. Okay, that's the same thing. Your skeleton is not ever seen. Except I had a CAT scan, and that was just disgusting. I mean, that's me inside. Ew. Okay, so we never see that core. We always see it with the inflation premium around, just like we always see you wearing a meat suit. Okay? I don't know what the hell that was for, but anyway. Together, these are called the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate. We don't see this one, actually, but we see something that is extremely close to it. The rate on a very short-term government treasury bill is, that yield, is pretty much the risk-free rate. It is the rate that you would get for just giving up consumption. No risk whatsoever, just giving up consumption for a while. Now, why is a government treasury bill risk-free rate? Because the government will pay you back. There's no default in there possible. There's no maturity in there. There's no difficulty selling the thing. It is so perfect that it is very close. We say it is a proxy for the risk-free rate. So if I show you those tables I was looking for that now the government is not showing where they used to, that would be those 1 year, I'd look down that column and I'd see day-to-day the risk-free rate, the yield on a one-year Treasury bill. Sometimes it's kind of big. These days, it is so low that it's almost, well, there are some who say it's actually gone negative a few times. Bizarre as that might seem, the risk-free rate has gotten that low. Now, again, the Treasury bills are virtually risk-free. The government will pay you back what it borrows from you. If you lend the government money, you will get it back. I mean, the government, if it has to, it'll raise taxes to pay you back. If it can't do that, well, then it'll just print some money to pay you back. And if its printing presses are gone, we'll just attack a country and liquidate its assets and say that it deserved it, and we'll use that to pay you back. And yes, we have done all three of those. It's risk-free. So in other words, when I say risk-free rate, which we see a lot in this course in the second half, we usually use as a proxy a one-year T-bill, the yield on a one-year T-bill. And right now, you know what? That was really weird. There was a government site. Let me try this. Let me do the search this way. Yield. Let me do it this way. I swear, this was where it used to be. Really? Oh, there it is. Oh, thank God. Really? This is not the same site. Well, this just sucks. 2022... It's not giving it the way it used to. It used to be just a nice list, and I don't get it why it's doing it this way. Okay, well, this would be about the closest that I could get. Is a 52-week right now. The yield on it right now is about 1.03%. Notice how it's been going up. Do you see this? Do you see how it's been rising recently? That's the Fed trying to squeeze the money supply a little bit, very gently, because it's afraid if it squeezes it too hard, the economy is fragile and it'll buckle under the squeeze. I mean, if you cut off the money supply right away, I mean, the economy is going like that. So if we're going to do it, we're going to have to do it fairly slowly, and the Fed is already starting that, as you can see. But notice, do you see how the yield slipped down from yesterday to today? That was what you saw in that chart. The yields are trying to recover now and go back up from that down day yesterday, a down day on Friday. But one way or the other, this is about risk-free. In other words, about 1.03% is what you should earn for just giving up your money for a year. With no risk whatsoever, you'll get it back. That's about what the markets are saying you deserve right now. Now, if you want to take some chances and do some risky stuff, well, you'd get more. That's the whole point of investing in corporate bonds instead of government bonds. That's what you get for investing in stocks instead of bonds. That's what you get for investing in anything that is more risky than perfectly riskless. Anyway, this thing is the risk-free rate, R sub F. It is like the base, foundation of all interest rates. No interest rate should be below this. Well, I saw this car dealership was offering me 0.5% APR. No, it wasn't. It's just jacking up the price of the car, really. This is like the base interest rate for all interest rates. It sits down there, and any other interest rate is stacked on top of that for different reasons, which I'll show you in a minute here. Okay, now, the next thing I'm so looking forward to having this mask mandate over. We may have it over after spring break, but we'll see. It gets so dry in my throat. Okay, now. The interest rates that you are typically going to encounter for a home loan, a car loan, the yield on an investment, return on investment, all that, it will have a risk premium in it that has three parts. These are additional interest points, or whatever you want to call them, that are there because of factors that drive whatever the asset is that you're borrowing on. The first of these is the default premium. You'll see me sometimes slip into the old notation, R sub D. DP is default premium. This is the reward for the risk that the loan is going to default in part or in whole. Now, government debt, whether it's a short-term, intermediate-term, or long-term, has no default premium because they will not default. Anything else will. Even a high-grade AAA corporate bond has a little default premium in it, a tiny one. And then as you get more and more risk, more of there's a higher default premium. So, for example, on a home loan, would you see a large default premium, madam, would you see a large default premium or a small default premium in the APR on a home loan? Actually, it would be small because there's an asset backing it the bank can get back if you default. So in other words, a collateralized debt would have a smaller default premium than an uncollateralized debt. Now, a car loan, it will have the car backing it, but it will still have a somewhat larger default premium just because you lose so much money when you drive a car off the lot that there's a chance that people will say, nope, I'm upside down on this loan, screw that, or some other reason. So even though that is a backed loan, a collateralized loan, it will have a slightly larger default premium. Then you get to some of these, like, for example, a student loan. Now, a student loan should have a high default premium, but actually it doesn't for a couple of reasons. Sir, do you have any student loans? Okay, what is going to happen if you don't pay your student loans? Well, they will send in black helicopters with a wet team rappelling down into your house. They will shoot your dog. They won't shoot the cat because the cat is cool. It's a cat. But they will take away all of your stuff, including your butt. They will get their money back. They have the power to garnish your wages and everything else. So they don't have to sweat. There's no sweat there. They will get their money back, I guarantee you. I had some student who found out my phone number, and she put my phone number on her student loan about 10 years ago. And I'm getting these collectors calling me for it. Well, we're going to come and kick your ass. Get away from me. That was some weird person. You know. Seriously, I mean, it's just kind of scaring me right now. But, yeah, that one's back. Now, let's try this one. You ever notice that credit card debt is very high interest? It's uncollateralized. I mean, it's very high default premium because there is a very high probability of defaulting on some or all of that debt. That's why you think, well, they're ripping me off with that. Well, yeah, but no. There's a very good chance that someone will default. So everyone pays a price for that that higher probability of defaults. So this default premium is actually a lot the driving force behind what an interest rate that you pay is. Mortgages, low default premium, so you get low mortgage APRs. The APRs are low. Car loans, Well, they are higher, even if the car company says we've got this great, you know, 1% financing bull crap. They're just embedding it in the price and on up from there. Now, here's one. Liquidity premium, which you might see me slip into the old or the illiquidity premium, as we used to say. You see, suppose that you decide to live la vida loca, and you say, I'm going to buy, madam, you say, I'm going to buy, lend the government $1 million for 30 years. Yeah, you can do that. What you do is you buy a 30-year original issue treasury bond. You can do it if you have $1 million. And you'll pay $1 million for it. And then you'll get these coupon payments, and then at the end you'll get your $1 million back. That's how government debt works. That's how corporate debt works. But now you say, you know what? I really, really could use that $1 million. I'm tired of this. I can't wait 30 years for my $1 million back. So you decide you want it back. You know what? You can get it back anytime you want. You just sell the bond. In the secondary market, you can sell it. You might not get exactly $1 million, depending on whether it's a premium or a discount, but you can get it back anytime you want, very quickly. Corporate debt's the same way. You lend a corporation money, buy its bond. Let's say you buy a Netflix bond, a $1,000 Netflix bond. You can sell it the next day for what you pretty much for what you bought it for. That's liquidity. They're very high liquidity instruments. And so you don't want any extra reward. Well, I need a higher interest rate because I might not be able to sell it back very quickly. It's not that way. However, if you were to lend money to a very small corporation or even buy stock of a smaller corporation, you might not be able to get rid of that as fast as you want. Matter of fact, you might not even be able to get rid of it. So in a case like that, you're going to want extra interest because of the lack of liquidity that the instrument has. When I was, long, long ago, I was a penny stock broker. Now, when people bought stock, they say they thought the stock would go to $10. Now, they'd buy it for a dollar, and that meant that their yield would be 10 times that. However, I couldn't promise them that they could sell it when they wanted to. As a matter of fact, there were just people who would put in orders, I want to sell the 600 shares of stock in this company that I bought it from you yesterday. And I'd say, well, you're not going to get a dollar for it. I can maybe give you 40 cents, 60 cents. You see, meaning that I was discounting it, making the next buyer have a higher yield because it was very hard to get rid of that. That's the problem, is that I could borrow, I'm going to promise to pay you back $1,000 in a year. What you do is you might lend me $950. You'd collect $50 in interest. But this loser right here, you'd lend him only $900. So you'd make $100 interest on him because he's not as safe as I am. Look at me. I'm a very safe person. Look at him. Really? No. You see, that's the whole point that I'm making, is that you see that liquidity premium. He's more likely, you couldn't get rid of that. With me, you could sell that to someone else for $950. But you probably couldn't do that with his. You could only sell it for $900. So that liquidity premium represents an additional amount of interest for the possibility that you can't unload it fast if you needed to. Now, here's the one that's a little bit more complicated to think about. The maturity premium, R sub M. By the way, the liquidity premium and the default premium, you will not see either of those in a government instrument because they're so easy to sell, they're so safe. The maturity premium is everywhere. And as the name implies, it gets larger the longer the term of the debt is. It works like this. You, madam, borrowed for a home loan from me. I am Mr. Banker. You borrowed the money at 6% for 30 years. So I, the banker, am expecting to get 6% from you for 30 years. What happens if interest rates fall to 4%? Do you know what you'll do? You'll refinance the loan. And then I'm stuck with the new, suppose it falls to 4%. Well, you borrow the money from someone else, and I get the money back, and I can't lend it at anything but 4% now. So in other words, if interest rates fall, I get burned. So I'm going to punish you for that possibility. Well, what if interest rates rise? Did you know that the average homeowner keeps an existing home that he or she has bought for about 7 years? So I know that in 7 years, the loan probably will be paid off. But if interest rates go up, you probably won't move. If interest rates go to 10%, are you going to buy a new home at 10% when you've got an existing mortgage at 6%? No, you're not. You're going to keep that home. Even though you've outgrown that home, you now have, when you got it, you were a single person. Now you are two people. You have five kids. Your brother is living with you, and his ne'er-do-well friends are living with you in the garage. They keep coming out wearing gas masks for some reason. And they've got a grindcore metal band in the middle of the night. You want to move, but you're not going to because you've got a 6% loan, and if you have to buy a new home with a larger place and no place for them to live, so they have to camp at the back of the backyard, then you're going to keep that. So in other words, as a banker, I would love to have you get rid of that loan so I can relend the money at 10%, but you're not going to. So it doesn't matter which way interest rates go, I'm going to get burned. And the longer the term of the loan, the more likely interest rates are going to go down or up. That's why the maturity premium gets larger and larger the longer the term of the loan is. This is actually called the yield curve. And this affects all interest, all loans. All loans are driven, the length of the loan will drive. So in other words, if you get a loan for 20 years, the APR will be lower than the same loan, same terms, that was for 30 years. Simply because the maturity premium on a 30-year loan will be larger than the maturity premium on a 20-year loan. Because there's more time on a 30-year loan for the interest rates to move adversely to my interests as the banker. That's how it works. So in other words, you see these treasury bill rates that I've got right here, see these? These are very, they have no maturity premium to speak of. Simply because there is so little time for interest rates to move against the lender. But if you go out here, God, I wish, let me see if I can find a bond. Long-term rates. There we go. Remember that 1.03? $2.3 million. That is maturity premium. Pure and simple. A loan to the government for 1 year, there's very little reason for the interest rates probably won't move very much, so there's no risk. But a loan for 30 years, there is very good possibility that interest rates will move on you. There's a weird theory out there which actually is laughable these days. It's called expectations theory that says there's no such thing as a maturity premium. And I always wanted to ask one of those people exactly what you're thinking when you look at a 1 year rate and a 30-year rate. You see the 30-year rate higher than the 1 year rate. What exactly is it that you're that tells you that's not a maturity premium. So when the book mentions expectation theory, which is what these fools are thinking, don't take it too seriously. But anyway, see that right there? That combination, all those factors are what drive every interest rate you see. They are all, the risk-free rate is underneath all of them. And then some combination of these. So, for example, if you saw a corporate debt, let's say it's a AAA corporate bond, you'd see no liquidity premium to speak of because you can unload those, you can call a broker, boom, you've gotten rid of it. There would be a slight default premium because even a AAA corporation might default. Might. It's very unlikely. But you'd see, if it were a 30-year, there'd be a maturity premium in there. That'd be the big dominating thing in there. Now, suppose that it were a single A, less high quality bond. You'd see a larger default premium because there's more likelihood that it's going to default. Liquidity premium, I don't know. Single A's, I mean, I've never seen them have a hard time being sold unless the company is getting into serious trouble. But if it's a 30-year, it'll have the same maturity premium as that AAA. They'll carry the same one together. Now, I'll give you a good example of this. Netflix, a couple of years ago, issued 15-year paper. I think it was $1.2 billion in debt. And the interest rate was surprisingly high. Well, the maturity premium was there, but I mean, that would have been in any 15-year. The liquidity premium, Netflix, they'll be able to unload that. You could get rid of your Netflix bonds if you bought them and then you sold them. That was all default premium. There's a serious belief that Netflix has a chance of getting into serious trouble. Netflix just raised its rates on everyone, trying to get out from under that. But there's still a question, how long can they keep raising rates until people start saying, no, we're going to go to another service? So you see this actually playing itself out in real life. And I'll get more into that in the next lecture, but that's all I have for you today. I thank you.